Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Patterns of Care. Today we talk about the current use of genetic testing and related clinical management of patients with localized breast cancer. We're doing this in partnership with the American Society of Breast Surgeons, and we're hoping a lot of surgeons are on the line now or will see the replay of this as well. We have a great faculty today, both a surgeon, Dr. Kevin Hughes from the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston, South Carolina, and medical oncologist Dr. Mark Robeson from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. Today, we're going to focus on genetic testing in localized breast cancer, and is also just to keep in mind that, as in all of our meetings, we will be talking about the use of agents and regimens outside of FDA indications. So check out the prescribing information for each product for the approved indications as well. So each one of our faculty has prepared a presentation, short presentation, with a couple of cases to discuss, and that'll sort of be the kind of infrastructure of what we're talking about. But layered on top of that is a survey that we're still doing right now. We're hoping to take the data from this survey in June, submit it to the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. We had three posters we presented there this year. Hopefully we'll be able to get one this year. What we're doing is really focusing on surgeons, seeing what they're doing. And so we're going to show you the results of what we learned so far. We have 10 surgeons who are located in tertiary centers. Right now we have 22 community-based surgeons. So we're hoping by June we'll bring that number up to 50, but I think we have a pretty good idea right now of what's going on out there. And also, just to let you know that if you are a surgeon, have not participated, we would love to have you involved. We have a modest honorarium. It's just a 20-minute survey. Or if you're an oncologist or you know a surgeon who you think might be interested in doing this, please contact us. So before we get into the presentations and sort of the results of the survey, I want to just mention that we did three programs at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Meeting. This is one of them on endocrine therapy of breast cancer. And one of the faculty I actually met with last Friday, Sarah Hurwitz, is a well-known medical oncology investigator. This was just a podcast we were doing. And she presented this case, and as I heard her present the case, which, of course, she was really getting into the issue of the use of adjuvant CDK inhibitors, and this is a patient who actually got adjuvant ribociclib, but she was a 65-year-old woman, and I noticed, and you'll see there in the middle of her write-up, Mark, that her genetic testing was negative. And I said, well, that's interesting, because, you know, there's no family history. She was ER positive, HER2 negative. What prompted you? And you can see she had a higher oncotype. She actually got chemotherapy because of that. And I said, well, why did you test her? And she said, well, the ASCO Society of Surgical Oncology guidelines say anybody 65 or younger, she's 65. And I want to use that as a way to just introduce what I found to be somewhat confusing. I mean, Kevin's going to get into it in his talk, but I just wanted to sort of bring this up to get started. Mark, you were the head of the ASCO SSO panel that put together these recommendations. If you could just summarize what your thinking was. You know, we had the American Society of Breast Surgeons saying test everybody. We had the NCCN saying test everybody 50 or over and selectively over 50. And of course, we were really interested with these three guidelines out there, what people are doing. That's what we're going to show you. And actually, I'm surprised there's not even more heterogeneity that we found. We found a lot of homogeneity, but particularly as it relates to age, a lot of difference. Also interesting, Mark, and we'll get into this later, that this lady was considered high enough risk to get chemotherapy because of her oncotype and also high enough risk to get a CDK inhibitor, which she was node negative. Not everybody gets a CDK inhibitor, and yet really doesn't necessarily meet the guidelines, at least in terms of what the Olympia trial looked at in terms of risk for. So maybe if she was 70, she wouldn't have been tested. And yet I would say, well, would you really, you know, if you knew she was BRCA positive, would you consider a LAPR, even though maybe she doesn't get into the criteria for the Olympia trial. So I know that's a lot, and we're not going to be able to solve it all in this 1 hour, Mark, but let's just get into it a little bit. I find this totally fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about what you all were thinking about when you put together this guideline?
So I think that we have a broad consensus now that BRCA1, BRCA2, and probably PALB2 mutations are extremely relevant clinically for the individual with breast cancer. I mean, it's therapeutically relevant. It's always been surgically relevant. And so failing to identify them potentially will deprive somebody of either prevention opportunities or even treatment opportunities. And we know that the NCCN guidelines themselves are relatively insensitive in the sense that they miss a reasonable number. So when you start looking at who gets missed by the NCCN criteria, it is generally hormone receptor positive women between the ages of 50 and 65 who don't have a family history that would otherwise push them towards testing. Those are the folks who get missed. Women who are over 65, if they don't have triple negative breast cancer, are very unlikely to have a BRCA1, BRCA2, or PALB2 mutation. And so the idea was to capture the great majority of people who were missed by the NCCN criteria, while at the same time not testing that extremely large number of women over the age of 65 who are very unlikely to have a mutation. The issue of PALBO the issue of olaparib in a setting like this is, no, I would not. I wouldn't go off book and use it outside of the Olympia guidelines for most people right now, especially kind of borderline risk like this.
So, Kevin, I'm curious about your perspective. I was chatting with both of you before we began, and I guess another issue that sort of comes into this thing with guidelines is reimbursement and how payers look at this. Again, any comments, Kevin? If it were up to you, would you test everybody?
If it was up to me, I'd test everybody. And the American Society of Breast Surgeons guidelines is that genetic testing should be offered to all breast cancer patients. Having said that, I'm also concerned about the reimbursement issues that you brought up. The insurance companies tend to respect NCCN. They respect the ASCO, but they don't use it as much, I don't think, or SBS as much. Part of my concern is if surgeons order the test and then it gets denied, they may not order the next test because they'll be afraid of getting denied again. So I tend to go more with the NCCN guidelines just to avoid the denials. And I would agree with Mark in part that people between 50 and 65 get missed who don't have a family history. But the other problem is that people between 50 and 65 with a strong family history also get missed because the NCCN guidelines are so difficult to get your head around. You know, it's more than three relatives with prostate or breast or prostate with high risk. It's very difficult to keep all that in your mind at one time. So I think that's part of the reason moving to test everybody is the right way to go. We just have to get the insurance companies to come along. They've come along for pancreas, for colon, for ovary. They need to come along for breast.
So a couple quick questions from the chat room. Mark Vish wants to know, what did you do genetic testing in a 74-year-old woman with bilateral disease? And also, Peter would like you to review the Olympia guidelines for adjuvant olaparib.
I'll take the first one. Bilateral breast cancer is in the NCCN. So even at age 75, you would test them by NCCN guidelines. So I'd certainly test that patient. And I'll leave Mark with the olaparib question.
Yeah, I mean, the olaparib criteria are somewhat complicated. If somebody has triple negative disease, so first of all, it's HER2 negative, not HER2 positive. If they receive neoadjuvant therapy and they have residual triple negative disease, they're eligible. If they receive neoadjuvant therapy for hormone receptor positive disease and they have significant residual according to the CPS-EG score, which nearly nobody uses, but if they have significant residual disease, then they're eligible. If they are receiving treatment in the adjuvant setting, it's either T2 or N1 triple negative disease. And if it's ER positive, it's N2 or greater. In other words, four more positive nodes. So basically a fairly high risk group of patients.
Yeah, I mean, very high risk. Again, we, you know, Sarah's patient, you know, to me is pretty high risk, and yet she's not even close to, you know, she's no negative. So no way with ER positive, HER2 negative. I really wonder, too, you know, with the tolerability side effects issue of olaparib, you know, compared to something like a CDK inhibitor, is it really that much more risky, et cetera? But I guess there are economic issues as well. But anyhow, I want to really focus on what's actually happening in practice. So just want to try to run through and kind of get both of your thoughts about what we're seeing about what's going on in practice, which I think reflects what we just talked about, which is, you know, the desire to test, but yet, you know, maybe concerns about reimbursement. So we, in this survey, we focused on three localized breast cancer situations. One, a low volume situation, less than 2 centimeters, normal axilla. Another would be a larger tumor over 2 centimeters with or without suspicious axilla. And finally, a patient with a larger tumor who's going to go for neoadjuvant systemic therapy, whether it's because they're triple negative or because of tumor size. And then the other variables we looked at, we just picked out 3 ages just to sort of see if we could and of course we saw almost everybody, we're not going to even show it. The entire survey, incidentally, is in the chat room if you want to see it. We're just going to show some of the slides there, but we're not going to show you the 30, because everybody for age 30 says test. A lot of heterogeneity, about 55, you know, that's over NCCN, but less than ASCO. But I'm going to show you 70 years old where age isn't an issue with these guidelines and see when people test. And then we varied ER and HER2 status and family history. So we try to keep it simple, although life is never simple. But anyhow, one thing we said, we asked people was what they think about in terms of guidelines. And actually, it looks like all 3 of these guidelines people are aware of and think about. But again, as Kevin's going to talk about, they're pretty different in what they said. Most people are going for panels. Mark, any thought about assays that just focus on BRCA versus panels?
I mean, I think that from the standpoint of clinical utility, that's what one would do. From the standpoint of everything else, nobody does it that way. So, I mean, everybody does panels now. I think that a lot of the discussion is how big is the panel?
So here's what happened. We asked people, do you have like a bar of age, the way the guidelines, or at least the NCCN and ASCO do? And actually, some people, a minority of people said, no, they don't have any age guidelines at all, which is kind of interesting. But for the majority who do have, you can see there's a big split, a lot of heterogeneity in how people look at the variable of age. Another thing we asked about was situations that where you just test everybody regardless of age. We saw a lot of agreement on this. We just talked about bilateral breast cancer, but also patients with triple negative breast cancers, all male patients, people with Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry. I was impressed that the community-based surgeons seemed to kind of be on the ball as much as the tertiary surgeons were. And although, again, there's a lot of challenges in sort of figuring this out. Kevin, another thing I was curious about as a medical oncologist was, what are the situations where a surgeon sees a patient and says, I want to see your BRCA before we decide what to do in terms of local therapy, a patient who, you know, maybe high suspicion for BRCA, where you might want to think about breast-conserving surgery. So, for example, bilateral mastectomy. You know, we gave a situation of a patient whose mother had a germline BRCA, where, you know, you would test them anyhow, but particularly the question of if she wanted breast-conserving surgery, maybe to know about that in terms of bilateral mastectomy. Also, Ashkenazi Jewish woman who wants to have breast conserving surgery. Kevin, in general, what are the situations where you want to see genetic testing before you make a recommendation for surgery?
I think the absolute place that's important is the patients who are under 35, because there's a possibility of them having a TP53 mutation. If you have a TP53 mutation, you cannot do conservation because you can't give radiation. and their risk of a second cancer is extremely high. So that's an indication definitely for testing. Other than that, following the NCCN is the appropriate thing to do. Certainly anybody 50 or less, I'd want to know the information about the patient. But we don't have a knee-jerk of, it's positive, you must have a bilateral mastectomy. I think that the BRCA-positive patients do have some choice. I think they have to understand the high risk in the opposite breast that they have. But conservation is still a reasonable approach. Most women don't take it. Most women are taking the bilateral mastectomies, but it's a reasonable approach. I think we also want to be careful if you do test a 70-year-old woman or a 75-year-old woman and she's positive, I would not do a bilateral mastectomy on her unless she insisted. I think her risk going forward is not at the same level, at least within her lifetime. So again, there's not this knee-jerk of you must do a bilateral mastectomy if you're positive. And I want to be careful that people understand that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I hadn't thought about that. That's interesting. Let me show you some more of the data we have. I don't want to discuss every single thing. I just want to kind of give you a 30,000 square foot view of what we see in general. So we picked out the 70-year-old patient. So based on age, she's outside of the guidelines. And so first, with a smaller tumor that's ER positive, HER2 negative, no family history, most people would not test the patient, as you can see down there at the bottom, although, you know, a fair number would, and maybe along the lines of every patient should be tested. We take that same situation, say the patient has a family history, and most people flip into testing the patient. We ask also about HER2-positive disease, and you were talking about Olympia, and of course, Olympia did not allow HER2-positive patients in there, so adjuvant olaparib is not going to be an issue, but you still have the issue of the familial risk. So we said ER-positive, HER2-positive, again, age 70, most people would not test. Family history, they do test. And then finally, triple-negative, where most people show a test no matter what the age or stage situation is, so regardless of family history, and even more so with a family history. This is another situation where the tumor is larger, but the patient's not thought to require neoadjuvant therapy, and they're not going to go to a medical oncologist. You notice that we put some answers in there, because remember, we're asking surgeons. This is a survey of surgeons here. So we also asked them, well, okay, even if you're not going to make the decision, like, for example, you know this patient is going to see a medical oncologist because they're getting neoadjuvant therapy, would you just leave it up to the medical oncologist? But then we still said, but in general, what do you think about it? And again, in the situation of a patient with no family history, ER positive, HER2 negative, most people would not test, even with larger size tumor. Family history, again, that flips over. HER2 positive, again, same thing. Most people don't test. They do if there's a relevant family history. And again, triple negative, most people say they test regardless of the situation. And then we really saw pretty much the same thing when we say, okay, this patient's going to go to a medical oncologist. We saw more people saying, hey, yeah, we'll leave it up to the medical oncologist. But we still saw the same basic pattern in terms of whether people test or not based on family history, ER, HER2 status, and age. And just want to come back to Mark and ask, first of all, have you seen much data out there in general about what people are actually, like what we're trying to ask, what people are actually doing in practice? And any thoughts about what we're starting to see here in this preliminary survey?
I mean, I think that what's happening in practice is very, I don't know if I have a particularly good window into it, given where I sit. I think what happens in a, you know, metropolitan area, particularly with a lot of tertiary centers, may be very different from what happens in a less well medically served area. And I think that these data, what you're showing, the main thing that they're illustrating is that kind of people aren't so crazy about testing folks who are older and very unlikely to have a mutation, but it is impressive that the group is aware of the triple negative thing. HER2-positive disease, by the way, is not commonly associated with mutations, which is one of the reasons why it's, I mean, one of the reasons it wasn't included in Olympia, but HER2-positive disease is underrepresented in BRCA mutation carriers.
So again, Kevin, any thoughts about what we're seeing both in the tertiary setting with surgeons as well in the community-based setting?
Oh, no, I think the what you're showing is good data. What I've found is that community surgeons tend to be more aggressive in doing the genetic testing themselves. And in doing the testing themselves, they cut out that problem of we refer to the genetic counselor, but the patient never shows up. So the point-of-care testing that the community surgeons do is very useful and very good, and they seem to be on top of the right patients to get tested. I think the academic surgeons know who to test, but then they have that barrier of referral. That can be a problem.
So one other issue we asked about, and we saw some heterogeneity here, and I'm just kind of curious what you are doing at your place and what you're seeing in the community. Is genetic counseling, Mark? Of course, now, you know, we've seen a lot of online services available, even some associated with the actual assays as well. Any thoughts about who should be recommended to have genetic testing and how it should be done and what your experience is, if any, with online genetic counseling?
So we have, you know, once again, I'm sort of extremely privileged here, and we don't generally do online counseling because we have a pretty large counseling core. But we have now moved towards much more of a mainstreaming model with a relatively limited upfront consent, with a sort of video education. I wouldn't necessarily even call it counseling. And then patients, if they do have a mutation, we catch them. They're automatically referred into our genetics program for discussion and cascade testing out to the family. So we're very much in a mainstreaming model now. And we've done this on literally thousands and thousands of patients, and it has been just fine. We should write it.
Kevin, any comments, Kevin? And also, you know, our group, we've done obviously tons of education for physicians, but we're also interested in patient education. Even though you don't really need counseling prior to this, it seems like maybe it would be an area that people would be interested in getting more information. I'm not sure what the best source of that would be at this point. But how do you think through, or what are you seeing in terms of genetic counseling? And any thoughts about online genetic counseling, Kevin?
Yeah, so a few things there. I think genetic counseling is great, but as Mark has said, we've really moved in breast surgery and breast care more to the mainstream model with the point of care testing. And that's worked well for us. It's a very minimal informed consent in advance. The patients have a very high rate of uptake because you're talking to them as their physician, so they're used to you. They want to do what you recommend. So I definitely recommend the point of care testing. The teleservices are great. It's fine to have the counseling by that. But the problem then becomes after you're done counseling these patients, they're sent a test kit, and then some 20% of time or more they never return the kit. So the online testing is great, but getting the uptake again, not just to answer the phone, but also to send the kit in is a problem. So those are all things that I think can be improved upon. One area is now the minimal residual disease testing that's being done in colorectal surgery and now a little bit in breast surgery. When you do that test, by just checking an additional box, you get germline testing at the same time. And that is very underutilized. Physicians order the MRD, but they don't check the box for the germline at the same time. And that's a place we really could increase the number of tests being done tremendously.
So before we get into Kevin's talk about genetic testing, a question from the chat room, Mark, from Dr. Kumar, from the Florida Cancer Specialist, about the, and you're going to talk more about adjuvant therapy with PARP, specifically Olaparib, but you put it out there, so maybe we can just comment on it. The issue of second cancers, you talked about the fact that in ovarian cancer, we're seeing some signals, particularly these patients are getting a lot of chemotherapy, et cetera. Where we are right now in terms of AML, MDS, solid tumors with the use of adjuvant PARP, And another question in terms of tolerability of a lap rib generally, we're talking about testing, you know, people 70, 75. You know, is a 75 or 80 or 85-year-old woman generally able to tolerate adjuvant or lap rib?
So two questions. I will show you data about second malignancies, but the top line is that there's no increase in AML-MDS, and there's some decrease in second BRCA-associated malignancies, but it's not clear that it's a true preventive effect. You know, tolerability, I think the probability of needing adjuvant therapy in that setting, you know, a very older person, is so low that I actually haven't had the experience. I have treated older patients with metastatic disease, and variable effect. I mean, you know, people who are just like everything else, if they're compromised when they start therapy, they do worse with it. But if they're robust when they start therapy, they do just fine. I mean, my own experience has been that olaparib is actually a pretty tolerable drug, and especially if you kind of play around with it at the beginning if you need to. And I haven't had big problems with tolerability myself.
All right, well, let's get into some of the data here. And Kevin, you put together a few slides to review some of the issues we've been chatting about.
Sure. So Neil is nice enough to give me a few questions to go over. And one was, what is the optimal approach to genetic testing? And for me, the optimal approach is to test the patient before they develop cancer. Unfortunately, we have this mindset of the patient comes in, it's a young breast cancer, they meet NCCN, let's get them tested. That's really too late. The ideal time is to test them when you identify early on they're at high risk of mutation. You test them, and then you put them on the appropriate management strategies to find this cancer earlier or to prevent it altogether. And Mary Claire King said it best. She said, to identify a woman as a carrier only after she develops cancer is a failure of cancer prevention. It doesn't mean that it's not useful. It's useful to get the information for the olaparib question. It's useful to get the information for her oophorectomy to prevent ovarian cancer. It's useful for her family. But the ideal time is before she develops breast cancer altogether. Now, what that really means is that right now, we know that 10% of breast cancer is hereditary. We have 367,000 breast cancers each year. That's 36,000 hereditary cancers that could have been prevented or found earlier had we done the genetic testing appropriately. And that's over 350,000 women in the last 10 years. So this is a major healthcare issue from my point of view. And getting this problem fixed where patients are tested appropriately long before they have cancer is the right way to go. Now, in terms of strategies for interdisciplinary care, genetic testing is everybody's responsibility, basically. We all have to ID who needs testing. Refer them appropriately or do the testing yourself. And as Marcus said, as we've said here, the mainstreaming of the testing, make sure it actually gets done while the patient's there in front of you and you don't have that problem of losing them over if they have to go somewhere else. And as I mentioned briefly, minimal residual disease testing or now tumor sequencing for targeted therapy, most of these companies have the ability to just check a box and get germline testing at the same time. And I would strongly encourage people to do that, to get the germline testing done when they do any genetic test, whether it's somatic or germline. Now, these are the breast cancer genes. There are a few that are a few more you might add to the list. You might take one or two off the list, but these are the basic genes you might think about. But when we're doing genetic testing, again, I do large panels. Mark does large panels. Everybody does panels. We're picking up genes for other cancers as well, but these are the breast cancer ones you might think about. Now, in percentage-wise, a little bit small slide, but basically about 89% of your patients are negative, all told, but about 11% are carriers of one mutation or another. Of the ones who are carriers, they lean more towards BRCA1 and BRCA2. There's also a smattering of other genes as well that you need to be aware of and concerned about. This is one lab, and these are all the different panels that lab offers. This is really unmanageable. I mean, to expect a surgeon or any physician to know all these different panels and which one to use at which point in time is just not reasonable at all. And I don't know why we'd go this panel route personally. For me, I get the biggest panel to get my hands on, And that's my tendency. And I'd say if you're going to try to choose one of these panels, and the question would be, pick one. Before I get into that, this is a great article I dug up talking about panels. And it's talking about how it's entirely premature to recommend routine use of multiple screening tests and on and on and on and on about this. But what's interesting about this article is that it was written back in 1970. And what they were arguing about was whether you should do a multiphasic chemistry screen. They saw you should decide, oh, let's do a chloride in this patient. Oh, let's do a cholesterol on this patient. And this to us is passé. And this is kind of where we are with genetics. Why are we doing these small panels when we can do a large panel for the same price? So the way I look at this is if you want to decide which panel to test, it depends on which patients you want to miss. So what genes don't you care about that you don't care if the patient has a mutation, you don't want to know? And a way to think about this is when you order a CT scan, do you ever say to the radiologist, don't tell me about the kidneys. I'm not a kidney doctor. I don't understand kidneys. I don't want to know about kidneys. None of us do that. We do the CAT scan of the abdomen. We find something in the kidney, and we send it to a specialist. We send it to a urologist or a renal specialist to take care of it. I look at genetics the same way. Get a large panel. You find a positive result. You don't know what to do with it. You send it to a specialist at that point in time. So this just gives you an idea of how many patients you're going to miss depending on what you decide not to test. If you look at BRCA1 and 2 and the Lynch genes, those are the tier 1 CDC genes, you'll pick up about 25% of the carriers. But if you extend your testing out, you pick up all these other genes as well. So this is what you're missing by doing smaller panels. So you just do a smaller panel, how small do you want to be and what do you want to miss? Now, what's interesting is that I think panels will be irrelevant in the very near future. I mean, right now we're arguing about, well, do we do a 20-gene panel, an 80-gene panel, 142-gene panel? But you do an 84-gene panel, you find cancer risk, it costs about $1,500. You do whole genome, whole exome sequencing, you get 20,000 genes. You get cancer risk. You get cardiomyopathy and benign condition risk. You get recessive conditions. You could wipe out recessive disease. You get pharmacogenomics. And your price is approaching $1,500. So we can argue about panels all day, but in the next 3 to 5 years, we're just going to do whole exomes on everybody. And as far as the guidelines go, here they are. As you mentioned, Neil, Society of Breast Surgeons, all breast cancer patients. ASCO, everybody under 65, unless these other things are there as well. And NCCN, under 51, unless you meet one of these criteria that nobody can remember. So these are your different guidelines you can go with. NCCN has the advantage that the insurance companies recognize them, but I think we're very close to going to all breast cancer patients, and ASCO's halfway there. In terms of these genes, though, they are very different in how they act. So do not have the knee jerk that no matter what mutation you have, you do the same thing. They're not all BRCA1 or BRCA2. If you look at the non-carrier versus CHECK2, it's only a very modest increase in breast cancer risk. RAD51 C and D, also similar. But P10, BRCA1, sky-high risk. So when you're dealing with, do you do a contralateral mastectomy? Do you do a bilateral mastectomy preventively? It really depends on the penetrance of the cancer. Not all genes are the same. And in terms of contralateral cancer, BRCA1 and 2, there's a reason to do bilateral. Again, not required, but there's a reason to do it. For PALB2, CHECK2, and ATM, this is from Yadav's data from Mayo, the contralateral breast cancer risk is not high enough to say this patient must have it. They may want it, but you can't tell them they have to have it. And what we've done here is set up a hereditary cancer clinic, because I think part of the problem is that when you identify a patient as a carrier, it's not always clear who takes care of them. The primary doctors are being straddled with that, but they don't always understand all the implications. So we've set up a hereditary cancer clinic. The nurse practitioner sees every mutation carrier. They've ordered the tests. They follow them regularly and then try to identify these patients to make sure they follow the guidelines appropriately. So quick conclusion, test all your patients before they develop cancer, manage them by the guidelines, prevent cancer, find it earlier. And for those missed by the system, test a diagnosis, check the germline box, and help the family at least. Now, I can stop there. And Neil, do you want me to go into the cases at this point?
Yeah. Yes, would you please?
Sure. Very, very quick cases here. And again, showing the failure of our healthcare system, unfortunately. This patient's a 47-year-old female. Her mother tested BRCA2 positive in 2017. We're now up to 2024, and she's never had genetic testing done. And because of that, she's never had really intensive screening. So she presents with a large palpable mass in her breast with a positive node and a contralateral cancer. And then we test her after the fact. Now we know she's BRCA2 positive. This is something that was preventable. We could have tested this patient back in 2017. Either the patient was afraid of getting tested, her doctors didn't understand testing, she couldn't get into a genetic counselor, whatever the reason, we missed a major opportunity with this patient to prevent this horrible cancer I now have to deal with. And the other side of it is this poor patient, a 30-year-old woman now, her mother, BRCA2 positive. The patient did exactly what she was supposed to do. She got BRCA2 testing and was BRCA2 positive at age 24. The guidelines are to get MRI yearly from 25 to 30 and add mammography at 30. She had a mammogram, a mammogram, a mammogram, a mammogram, all negative, and then shows up with a 6-centimeter cancer that could have been picked up by MRI 1 or 2 years earlier, I would anticipate. So this, again, it's not good enough to do the testing. You got to follow the patient appropriately and do the, and follow them by the guidelines.
So, Mark, any comments about these two cases? And also, you see patients who have been referred in after being managed in the community setting. What are the obstacles out there in terms of getting patients tested and then when they're identified to be BRCA positive, screened appropriately?
Well, I think the obstacles are access, recognition, you know, the same problems that we've had for 30 years now. And there is a element of reluctance on the part of patients as well, which is part of the reason why, you know, first of all, referrals to genetic counseling often don't get followed through on, and cascade testing within families where mutations are identified is not great. I mean, the number of eligible people who pick up testing is really small. But I do think that there's, you know, access issues, particularly in, you know, rural underserved areas and certainly underserved urban areas as well.
So, Mark, I agree with you. And I think also, though, is the reluctance of patients is partly how we present genetic counseling, how we present genetic testing. I think we've made it too scary. I think we've talked about all the obstacles, all the problems. We've talked about you're going to have both your breasts removed unnecessarily. The doctor's going to do the wrong thing. You're going to lose your insurance. We've really concentrated on the negatives of genetic testing and not on the positives of finding these cancers early and preventing these people from dying. I think that's part of the issue of why patients are reluctant.
Yeah, I think there are certainly a number of things that go into it.
So the other issue in terms of the value of testing to the patient, of course, is the potential to receive adjuvant treatment with olaparib. And in a second, Mark's going to review the data and talk a little. We've had a number of questions in the chat room about this, but we were just curious what surgeons, the level of awareness they have about this. And I was actually kind of surprised how well-informed at least the surgeons were that took part in this survey. Most of them are aware that the olaparib is given for a year. And also that both not only progression-free survival was improved, but also overall survival, as Mark is going to show you. In terms of non-hematologic adverse effects, a lot of sensitivity and awareness, a lot of that may be coming from our extensive use of PARP inhibitors in ovarian cancer, where this issue of GI toxicities has come up. I'm just kind of curious, Mark, do you use preventive anti-GI medications in patients starting PARP inhibitors or olaparib, or you just wait and see what happens first?
I always give them a prescription. I mean, the nausea that's associated with olaparib is usually something that occurs in the first few weeks and then tachyphylaxis out. So I'll usually start people or at least give them a prescription for Zofran or Compazine and tell them that they might feel bad and to take it. That usually takes care of it.
Also, again, a lot of awareness of the potential for cytopenias with PARP inhibitors, including olaparib. You know, again, we know from ovarian cancer, some of the other PARP inhibitors affect platelets more. Olaparib, a lot of times, is thought of in terms of anemia. Mark, what do you see in the particularly in the adjuvant setting in terms of cytopenias?
Generally, you know, there's about a 6% grade 3 anemia rate. It's not trivial, but most of the anemia is kind of on the order of what you see with adjuvant chemotherapy and or, you know, for that matter, CDK4/6 inhibitors. So, again, usually not dose limiting, usually not requiring transfusion.
And again, we talked about this issue of second cancers and the fact, at least at this point, based on the Olympia trial, we're not seeing that. Most people seem aware of it. We also asked in terms of specific indications for the use of adjuvant treatment, both in the, right now, again, it's not approved. It hasn't been studied with HER2-positive disease, but HER2-negative disease, whether it's ER-positive or not, depending upon the risk status, and Mark's going to get into that a little bit more deeply. So, Mark, can you talk about the data, and then we'll go through a couple of cases?
I will. I'll try to go extremely quickly. So, PARP inhibitors in breast cancer first came online in the metastatic setting, and unlike the situation in ovarian cancer, I think we unfortunately have to admit that they were kind of meh. And although they did have progression-free survival advantages, no overall survival advantage. And the reason for this is probably that, breast cancer patients often have gotten adjuvant therapy with DNA-damaging agents, particularly anthracyclines. And so that tends to introduce resistance through a mechanism called reversion, which is where the gene essentially gets rearranged into a form that produces a functional BRCA protein and therefore makes the cell insensitive to PARP inhibition. So logically, the idea would be, well, then if we give the PARP inhibitor earlier, maybe it's going to be better. And there were some hints of that from the metastatic trials in sort of unplanned subset analyses. But Jennifer Litton was really the first one to start moving this into the truly early stage setting with a small trial of neoadjuvant talazoparib. And she just took mutation carriers who had generally relatively small disease and gave them talazoparib for a while and found that she had a nearly 46% pathologic complete response rate, whether you did it by investigator or by independent central review. So not bad at all in the pre-checkpoint inhibitor era. And I'd point out that this was both hormone receptor positive and hormone receptor negative patients. People have been trying to boost this. There's a trial, TBCRC56, with Erica Meyer presented the first part of at San Antonio, combining olaparib with a checkpoint inhibitor. And these are just the data from a relatively small number of hormone receptor positive patients. And what you can see is the combination had a 44% RCP 0 to 1. So again, good responses, not clearly enhanced by the checkpoint inhibitor, although we're waiting for the triple negative data from that study soon. So what about even earlier in the adjuvant setting? So this is the trial schema for Olympia, which I think we've probably all seen a lot by now. And the eligibility criteria are those which I discussed earlier. Everybody had received adjuvant chemotherapy, radiation therapy if they needed it. The hormone receptor positive patients went ahead and got anti-estrogen therapy. The residual triple negative patients did not get capecitabine. And then the randomization was 1-to-1 to olaparib or placebo. And I'll make a couple of comments about the population. It was an extremely young population. The majority of them had BRCA1 mutations. The majority were triple negative. And of course, none had HER2-positive disease. A lot of them had undergone mastectomy, and half of them had undergone bilateral mastectomy, and a lot of them had already undergone salpingo-oophorectomy, which is relevant for the consideration of the impact on second malignancies. And this is the website that where you can calculate the CPSEG score, but I think people generally just use the how high is the risk after neoadjuvant therapy for hormone receptor positive patients and then do it by gestalt rather than doing the calculation. So the updated data from 10 years after first patient in were presented by Judy Garber again at San Antonio this year, and the benefits have been sustained. There's a nearly 10% improvement in invasive disease-free survival at 6 years. And importantly, the benefit is seen in all subsets of patients, hormone receptor positive and triple negative. I keep harping on this because I do feel like the hormone receptor positive patients don't get tested enough, don't get thought of enough, and they do still derive significant benefit from PARP inhibition if the situation is appropriate. This is just Kaplan-Meier showing the same thing. Although the curves seem to come together for the ER-positive patients, the numbers out there on the tails are really, really small, and so I don't think those estimates are particularly robust, but just showing that, once again, both groups of patients seem to benefit. Distant disease-free survival and overall survival, also meaningful improvements. You know, hazard ratio for overall survival is 0.65, something in that neighborhood, 0.67. And those patients, you know, that's not quite the benefit that we saw from Herceptin, but it's not far off. Adverse events, you know, tolerability was good. As a matter of fact, relatively few patients had, you know, adverse events leading to death. There were fewer of them in the olaparib arm than in the placebo arm. These are the data for MDS-AML. Again, twice as many cases nearly in the placebo arm. And then pneumonitis wasn't increased and new primaries were reduced. I think that the difference between breast, particularly early breast, and ovarian is that all the ovarian patients have gotten a bunch of platinum by the time they get to olaparib. And you know, although we don't think of platinum as being leukemogenic, it is. And I suspect that that may actually have something to do with the difference between the two diseases. You also don't see AML-MDS really in prostate. And you certainly don't see it in pancreas because you don't have enough time usually. So this is, again, more data about second malignancies. You know, breast cancer is reduced, ovarian cancer is reduced, but I don't think that one can really take this to the bank just because so many patients had had preventive surgeries that there's just not enough people at risk to make any definitive conclusions, but there's certainly not an increased risk in anything that you can see. Other patient populations are kind of interest. So TBCRC48 was a trial run by Nadine Tung, which was looking at metastatic patients with HER2-negative disease and germline mutations in genes other than BRCA1 and BRCA2. And what was observed in the initial cohort was that there was a pretty dramatic response rate in patients who had germline PALB2 mutations, and that was confirmed in a follow-up cohort. Importantly, patients who had mutations in other genes like CHEK2 or ATM did not get any benefit from PARP inhibition. So just because some patients with germline mutations benefit doesn't mean that everybody does. And this is the somatic data. And patients who had somatic BRCA mutations also did seem to benefit, although not to the same degree as PALB2.
Before you get into the cases, just a few questions that are popping up in the chat room. A lot of interest in the neoadjuvant data. I mean, you had a path CR rate there that was pretty high. Do you see, you know, particularly, for example, triple negative disease, where we often use neoadjuvant therapy, are there trials ongoing now? You mentioned one, but what do you see as the future for a mark of neoadjuvant PARP? And also, Kevin, in a second, I'm going to ask you if you have any questions as a surgeon you'd like to see Mark address. But what about the issue of neoadjuvant PARP? Where do you see that heading, Mark?
You know, I think so. Neoadjuvant triple negative disease, you know, if you have a situation where you get neoadjuvant therapy, there's so much benefit from immunotherapy, and platinum is basically doing the same thing as a PARP inhibitor in that setting. So it's a little hard to see a substitution. Neoadjuvant therapy for hormone receptor positive disease, of course, is kind of complicated because, you know, what's the circumstance under which you do it? And my experience, we've had a neoadjuvant trial as well, and my experience has been that people are just nervous to use that, as to use a PARP inhibitor and not give people cytotoxic chemotherapy. And maybe if we got to a very low-risk situation, you know, T1A, T1Bs, triple negative, people might be willing to do it, especially with a lymphocytic infiltrate. But it's just very hard for folks not to give cytotoxic chemotherapy to high-risk disease.
So another question from the chat room, Mark. We were talking earlier about Sarah Hurvitz's, from Fred Hutch, Sarah Hurvitz's case of a patient who was getting adjuvant CDK, which we see now in higher risk ER-positive patients. Can you give PARP and CDK together, Mark?
you cannot give them together because of overlapping myelosuppression, but you can give them sequentially. I mean, if you remember in Natalie, it was 12 months from surgery before you could start the, no, 12 months from initiation of endocrine therapy before you started the ribo, or up to 12 months. And in Monarchy, it was 16 months. So I think you can give a year of olaparib and then follow on with the CDK4/6 inhibitor. There's data that we have in the metastatic setting, the first-line metastatic setting, that the patients who have BRCA mutations don't actually respond as well to CDK4/6 inhibitors as patients who don't have mutations. And there's a number of different possible explanations for that. But I'm not sure that BRCA carriers are going to get as much benefit out of a CDK4/6 inhibitor as they might. And you have an overall survival advantage with olaparib, which you don't have yet with a CDK4/6 inhibitor. Not as big a one. So I think I definitely would move towards PARP inhibitor first.
Really interesting. Kevin, anything you want to hear Mark talk about in terms of adjuvant therapy?
I'm very impressed with Mark's talk, as always. I would say, though, that you can't do pre-op therapy if the surgeon's already operated on the patient. So I would remind the surgeons in the audience, when you have a palpable lump, when you have a triple-negative cancer, when you have a HER2-positive cancer, please get your medical oncologist involved before you do the surgery. I'm a strong proponent of that.
Do you think there's a gap in that right now? I kind of had the feeling that at this point people are pretty tuned into neoadjuvant. What do you think, Kevin?
I don't think we're perfect. I think it does happen. I think it's I think breast surgeons in general are aware of how to treat breast cancer well, and I think they are aware of pre-op therapy. It does add some complexity to the situation. It does mean you have to get another physician involved before the surgery goes on. You have to then work with them to figure out what you do first. There are some barriers there that I think are not that are still a problem. I think we're doing very well, but I think we could certainly do better.
So I love our chat room. They always bring up stuff I don't know about. So Javier says, Mark, what about DCIS? He says, I don't know, but he says that's a testing under age 50, testing is supported by NCCN, but according to him or Javier, not mentioned in the ASCO or American Society of Breast Surgeons guidelines. So what about testing patients with DCIS, Mark?
You know, I think that at least the ASCO guidelines just kind of said breast cancer, didn't necessarily specify invasive breast cancer. So, you know, And I do think you pick up mutations in patients with DCIS. Whether or not they're less prevalent, I think, is a little unclear. I would imagine that certainly older patients with DCIS, within the absence of a family history, would be less likely to have mutations. But the younger ones, it's pretty much the same.
Yeah, it makes sense, particularly from the family point of view. Another question, Mark. What about the patient who gets adjuvant olaparib and then later on relapses? Do you retreat with a PARP inhibitor? And if you do, do you use a different one?
I don't think that there's any reason to switch to a different PARP inhibitor. I think whether or not I would attempt retreatment would depend upon a lot of things, like how long has it been? What's the clinical state? You know, if you had a little bit of time, if you felt like it was kind of like, well, otherwise I'd give them capecitabine, but let me try this, maybe I would go for it. But if it was close, I probably wouldn't.
So, Mark, you picked out this 37-year-old woman as sort of a, quote, typical a patient who gets adjuvant olaparib. Can you talk a little bit about what happened with her?
Yeah, this is just a lady who I follow who, you know, came from overseas, actually, and she had a pretty decent-sized mass outside, and it was biopsied. It was PR low with weak staining, and so functionally treated like a triple negative, really high Ki-67, of course. And she had benign lymph node biopsy, even though it was enlarged. She got tested and had a BRCA1 splice site mutation, got her neoadjuvant ACT. She did not get a checkpoint inhibitor there, and had a fairly decent amount of residual disease. And so she had her oophorectomy, radiation therapy, and we started her on olaparib. So I was just using this as an illustration of really the most common situation for Olympia was residual triple negative disease. And you can, if you've given Keynote, you can continue the pembro and give olaparib at the same time. There's a ton of studies that have done that with no safety signals. You really cannot overlap olaparib and capecitabine. And because in Olympiad and in Imbruca, capecitabine was the most common physician's choice chemotherapy against which the PARP inhibitors were compared, with significant benefit in terms of overall response rate. And there's some data about duration of response. I prefer to use a PARP inhibitor than capecitabine in this setting.
And how long has this patient been under treatment, and how did she do when you started the olaparib?
She's been, I think she's four or five months now, and she did fine. I mean, had a little bit of nausea at the beginning, but not enough even to take any medication. She's tolerating it fine. Now she's running a little bit of anemia, you know, hemoglobin of like 10.5, 10, but she's not having any issues with it at all.
You know, the fact that she had this PR of 20% kind of reminds me of the issue of, you know, we've heard about her too low, but I've also seen people talk about ER low. So What do you treat patients who have, let's say, 10% or less ER positivity mark as triple negative, neoadjuvant, that whole thing, or ER positive?
You know, I tend to treat them as triple negative, the HER2 lows, particularly if they have a poorly differentiated tumor. I mean, not the HER2 lows, I'm sorry, the ER lows, particularly if they have a poorly differentiated cancer. There are some data that I think was presented at San Antonio, I can't remember exactly where, that there did appear to be benefit to endocrine therapy, even in patients who had supposedly ER low disease. So, I mean, it's not the greatest kind of study, sort of a retrospective look, but very little harm in tossing on a, you know, AI or tamoxifen if you wanted to do it, if you felt like it needed to be covered.
Yeah, I think that is a classic thinking, that you do see some benefit, but ER. But I think the thing about here is that the treatment of triple negative has changed so much now. Now, these people getting neoadjuvant, they get IOs. So it's a very different course that people take if they're labeled triple negative versus ER positive. So let's finish out talking about your other case, a 61-year-old woman. We had a question in the chat room about PALB2, and you mentioned that. What happened with this lady?
So this is kind of a fun case. This is a lady who was known to have a PALB2 mutation and was undergoing screening and found to have some architectural distortion. And then we had a contrast-enhanced mammo that showed symmetric enhancement, big enhancement, you know, 9 centimeters. And so she had a stereo biopsy that turned out to be, you know, invasive mammary. It was CDH. It was an ecadherin negative, so functionally lobular. ER-PR strongly positive with a very low recurrence score. So this is a situation where we give neoadjuvant endocrine therapy here. She had an oophorectomy. Whether or not that was necessary is unknown. And after 4 months, she had, you know, a pretty significant amount of residual disease. So I've showed you that in the metastatic setting, PALB2 patients are generally very sensitive to PARP inhibition. And so the temptation was, well, why don't I think about throwing a PARP inhibitor onto this lady? But what we did here, this is a little bit complicated. We fortunately have the ability to do a lot of genomic testing in-house, and so we did so in her. And she had a PIK3CA alteration. She had a CDH1 alteration, which you would expect for the ecadherin mutation. But otherwise, the plots on the right are copy number plots. And what you can see is that they're pretty bland. They're pretty flat, which is not what you would see in a homologous recombination deficient tumor. You'd see a lot of copy number changes. And as a matter of fact, there's not even loss of heterozygosity at PALB2. And we tried to run mutational signatures, but there weren't enough mutations to actually classify. So she didn't even have a homologous recombination deficient mutational signature. This one loss of heterozygosity that you can see far to the right is actually CDH1, not PALB2. So the point I wanted to make here was that even though the temptation was great, this lady would not have benefited from a PARP inhibitor. And as a matter of fact, she's on CDK4/6 inhibitor instead. She's on ribo instead. So cautionary tale that just because something looks like it might be great, it's not necessarily going to be.
Really interesting case. And interesting that you gave her neoadjuvant endocrine therapy, too. I found that interesting as well, though I guess it didn't have that much of an effect in this particular situation. So Kevin and Mark, thank you so much. Audience, thank you for coming on here tonight. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Kevin. Thanks so much, Mark.
Yeah.